Yarbalak ben Sipor Eis Kol Asher Asa Yisrael La Emori Vayogar Moav Mipnei Ha'am Me'od Ki Rav Hu Vayakatz Moav Mipnei Bnei Yisrael. Balak the son of Tzipor saw all that Israel had done to the Amorite. Moav became very frightened of the people because it was numerous, and Moav was disgusted in the face of the children of Israel.
OU Israel presents...
In. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Balak. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 8th day of Tammuz, 5776, corresponding to July 14th. First and foremost is a super apology. Really, really feel bad about it, that I did not manage to get a show out, neither last week or the week before. The fact of the matter is that my wife underwent a fairly serious operation 2 weeks ago, a little bit more, and she just got out of the hospital yesterday, and I was in Tel Aviv most of the time with her. She was at Ichilov Hospital. Her progress is very good, and it's a long process of recovery, and hopefully with Hashem's help it will become a refuah shlema. But I had with me my laptop and my headphones. I actually bought a new set of headphones in Tel Aviv, and I tried, and 1 week I had one problem, the other week I had another problem, and it just didn't happen. So I apologize, but here's my show today. So without further ado, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Shir Hama'alot Mima'amakim Kraticha Adonai, Adonai Shima V'Koli Tehiena Oznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai, Imavono Tishmaria Adonai Mia Amod, Ki imacha hasalicha lama'an tivare. Ki viti Adonai kivita nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara v'ashivya ha'omedim ebein bayam uvein bayabasha ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha u'me'afela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala u'vizman kariv v'nomar amen. It was a busy 2 weeks, and more than that, it was a distracting 2 weeks. I managed at considerable cost of time and sleep to get Torah Tidbits out both last week and this week. Has not been easy, and I hope things will go smoothly from now on. I want to take a look at Parshat Balak. I am sure that I have said this in the past. I have a little bit extra to add and maybe say it in a different way. But I find Parshat Balak almost uniquely so, a straight story episode in early Jewish life, followed by another story connected, as we will see, and nothing to distract us from learning lessons from the stories. Nothing meaning no mitzvot to focus on, and that allows the story to take front and center and capture our attention. Having said that, I do want to share with you what would have to be called here a side point, but it's an important one also that comes from the Sedra. But maybe I'll get it in sequence. The Sedra of Balak is made up of 104 psukim. 95 of them are in one portion, and then 9 more in the second portion. The 95 pasuk parsha could be, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm reasonably sure that it's the third largest parsha in the Torah. The other two are whole sedras by themselves, and here it's most of a sedra. But when you see such a large portion that is contained within one parsha, meaning that in a Torah scroll there are no breaks in the writing of the words. The words just flow and flow and flow, and only between parshiot do you have a blank space. So the first 95 psukim tell the story of Balak, the king of Moab, and Bilam, a world-renowned at that time prophet, and a Midianite. And as the Sedra begins, and the portion that I read, Balak sees all that Israel has done to the Emori, the Amorites, meaning defeating them, conquering them, and taking over their land. And Moab, the whole nation, as well as its king Balak, were very, very scared, very worried, very concerned. Vayogar Moab mipnei ha'am me'od, very, because Israel was a large nation, and they were disgusted with Moab, with Israel, because of perhaps their fears that they would be conquered as well. One can't dismiss that extra part of, and they were disgusted with Israel, as a typical theme of Jewish life, where whenever we were viewed as enemies, we were most often reviled by the enemy, which became a certain kind of justification to do or to attempt to do what they wanted to do. But in this case, the king of Moab knows very well that a military confrontation with Israel would lead to his defeat, because two more powerful city-states had already fallen to Israel, and Balak was not going to risk fighting. Instead, as I jokingly say, he Googled Israel, and among the many articles on the internet, he found a passage that spoke of Israel's reliance on a Navi, a prophet, and the prophet's words and God's words. And he said, okay, I have an idea now. Instead of using the sword against them, we will use words against them, because that seems to be their style. So he offers to employ Bilam ben Beor, as I said before, a world-renowned prophet among the non-Jews. Our Jewish sources say that Bilam was an exceedingly powerful prophet, and that was so that the nations of the world would not say, oh, sure, the Israelites, the Jews, have prophets, so they're close to God and they're great, and we don't, so what chance do we have? So God gave prophecy to prominent non-Jews as well, so that the world, the nations of the world, cannot say they have prophecy and we don't. So he asks Bilam to come to him and to curse the Jewish people. And Bilam at first flatly refuses, and then invites the delegation from Moab that came to see him to stay the night. Maybe God will tell me something different. And God says to him, the nation of Israel is blessed, and you shall not curse them. And Bilam sends the delegation from Balak on their way in the morning with a rejection. Balak turns around and sends a more prestigious delegation to plead before Bilam to come and curse the Jewish people. And Bilam righteously proclaims that he cannot do anything without God's permission. He cannot say anything without God, basically putting the words in his mouth. And stay overnight and maybe things will change. And overnight, God appears to Bilam and says, I'm warning you, you can't curse the people because they are blessed. But if you want to go with them, go. Just remember what I told you. So Bilam gets up enthusiastically in the morning, and he saddles his own donkey, which apparently was out of character for a man of his prominence, and indicating therefore that he was very excited and enthused by the possibility and the prospect of cursing the Jewish people. The delegation and Bilam get to Balak. They meet, and Bilam says, okay, you want me to do this? Build 7 altars and offer on them 7 bulls and 7 rams. And that was a significant offering and a significant number of offerings. I won't get into why that was so. And hold that thought, because I have to go back. On the way, and apparently the delegation was not with Bilam, because the Torah seems to indicate he was on the way on his own, God sends an angel to block his way. He does not see that angel. His donkey does, and his donkey veers from the path, and Bilam beats it back onto the path. The angel blocks again. Bilam does not see it. The donkey sees it, and this time he's on a path that has walls on both sides, and in trying to go around the angel, he knocks Bilam's leg into the wall, and Bilam beats him again. And a little bit further, the angel once again stands in the road with a sword drawn to block Bilam. Bilam does not see the angel. The donkey does. And with no place to maneuver, he just sits down under Bilam, and Bilam strikes him again. Then a remarkable thing happened. God opened the donkey's mouth, gave it the power of speech, very temporarily, and the donkey says to Bilam, what did I ever do to you to deserve being beaten these 3 times? And Bilam doesn't seem to be astonished by this, because he answers the donkey, saying, if I had a a stick in my hand, I would have killed you for not behaving the way you're supposed to. And then God allows Bilam to see the angel, and Bilam realizes that that was why the donkey was giving him problems. And Bilam offers the angel that if God doesn't want him to go, he'll go back. Now, you would have thought that the angel would say, that's correct, go back. But he doesn't. It's a classic example of giving someone enough rope to hang himself. In Hebrew, the expression is, "Bederech she'odam holeich molichin oto," in the path that a person is going on, God will sometimes guide him and let the consequences take care of the situation. So the angel allows Bilam to continue. Now, among many other things to be said about this encounter of Bilam with his donkey and the angel is the fact that Bilam was reputed to be such a great charismatic speaker of God's words, and here the power of speech was denied him. Actually, seeing the angel was denied him, and the power of speech was given to a donkey, as if God says to Bilam, don't be such a boaster. Don't be so arrogant as to think that you're the greatest speaker. If I choose, says God to Bilam, to give the power of speech to your donkey and let the donkey see an angel of God and not you, then be very, very careful. Take heed. And there are other things involved there, but let's get back on track, which was building the seven altars and offering seven bulls and seven rams. And then Bilam goes off on his own to meditate in the hopes that God will allow him to speak the way Balak wants him to and the way he wants to and curse the people. What happens instead is a very eloquent, poetic description of the people of Israel, and not at all in the vein of a curse. And Balak gets kind of annoyed, and he says, what are you doing? I hired you to curse the people. And Bilam says, hey, look, I told you, I can't say anything unless God allows me to say it. So let's try someplace else. And they go to a different vantage point overlooking the people. And Bilam has Balak again build seven altars and offer seven bulls and seven rams. And Bilam goes off on his own to meditate. And again, comes out with beautiful descriptions of the people of Israel and their uniqueness and their greatness. And Balak says, what are you doing to me? I spent a fortune getting you here to curse the people. Curse. Instead, you've blessed them twice. Bilam again plays innocent and says, I can't do what God doesn't allow. Basically, they try one more time, and there are commentaries who point out the significance and the locations of these points that Bilam and Balak attempt to curse the people. And for a third time, beautiful descriptions of the people, and nothing that sounds at all like a curse. And Balak is disgusted, and fires Bilam, so to speak. He said you could have had houses filled with gold and silver, and all you had to do was curse the people, and instead you keep blessing them these three times. Bilam again says, I can't say anything without permission from God. In essence, that's what he was saying. So he goes on his way, and Balak goes on his way, failed in their three times attempting to destroy the Jewish people by a curse, or at least make them vulnerable to attack via a curse. Before Bilaam and Balak part. Bilaam prophesies about many other nations as well. And basically, according to our tradition, the two of them cook up a scheme by which they say, well, if we have failed to defeat Israel by cursing them because God insists they are blessed, then how about this? Let's entice them into immoral idolatry, the combination of immorality and idolatry, and thereby causing God not to give his divine protection, and we will be able to defeat them that way, or they'll defeat themselves. So what those last nine verses in the second parsha of the Sedra contain is the episode of the Moabite and Midianite women, including nobility, seducing the men of Israel to their worship, which involved immorality and orgies and stuff like that, as well as idolatry. And then God got angry, and a plague broke out. And if it were not for the zealous action of Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen at the very end of the Sedra to actually pick up a spear and kill one of the Jewish leaders who was publicly behaving immorally, explicitly, with a Midianite princess. We don't even know their names in this week's Sedra. We'll find out in the beginning of Parshat Pinchas. Pinchas kills Zimri and Cozbi, and the plague stops. Death toll, 22,000. That is a hefty, 24,000. Let me just check that. Vayihu hametim b'magefa arba'a ve'esrim aleph. 24,000 fell to a plague based on God's anger, so to speak, in men of Israel turning their backs on him, so to speak, and undertaking the idolatrous practice to Baal Peor. Hold that thought. We'll be right back with more Torah Tibbetz audio for Parshat Balak. Allow me to do. You are listening to Torah Tibbetz audio for Parshat Balak. I interrupted myself in the middle because I went over the 23-minute mark. I took about, 19, 20 seconds, and then I'll continue from there, and then I'll tell you about the music that started the first half, as well as this half. And if it were not for Pinchas' action to jealously protect and preserve and guard God's honor, the death toll would have been much, much higher, and perhaps the people would have been wiped out. That's basically the Sedra. I have several things to say about it, and I'll do that after listening to the music that would have started this half. Instead, I'm putting it in now, and I'm leaving it longer than usual because it's just a very pretty theme song. So enjoy the music, and then I'll tell you why I chose it for Parsha Balak. Okay, the music that started the first half was, I go to a program called Television Tunes or Teletunes or something like that, which have theme songs for thousands of TV shows, current as well as from the past. And I put in a search word. This time I put in bird, because Vayar Balak ben Sipor. Balak's father was called Sipor, which means bird, so I wanted to associate it that way. Specifically, it was a theme from cartoons of Angry Birds, and Angry Birds sort of fits in because we dealt with the emotions, or we are dealing with the emotions of fear and disgust, and not exactly the same as anger, but I thought Angry Birds would do it. For the second half, I went looking back in the list of the birds' themes, and I came across a redone version of the theme song from a TV series called The Thorn Birds. It was quite a number of years ago. I remember it was serialized. I think it was from Australia. And I was quite taken by the series. A very powerfully done and sad story. But it was a certain beauty that suffused it. And Thorn Birds fits in to the words that I also read at the beginning of the Seder of Vayakatz Moav, that Moav was disgusted, and the word coats means thorn, and it could be that they perceived Israel as a thorn in their sides. So keeping the same theme of Tzipor and adding the dimension of the thorn birds. Look, that's how my mind works, and that's one of the things that identify my particular show of Torah Tibbetz Audio. It's not straight analysis of the Seder or other halachic things or Divrei Torah straight, but I try to keep things light and pleasant, even though I'm looking for the message angle as well. And I think most of the regular listeners appreciate that, and know it at least. Okay, the first thing that needs to be said, because I think it's a remarkable thing, is that those 95 verses of the story of Balak and Bilam are the only parts of the Torah from the beginning of Shemot till the end that we, the Jewish people, were totally oblivious to when it happened. Everything else in the Torah was done in full sight of a nation of 600,000 plus adult men, plus women and children, 2 to 3 million people. Everything that happened, happened with our seeing it, both good things like water coming from a rock that was struck, to the manna falling, to negative things like the rebellion of Korach and the sin of the spies. The common thread from the beginning of pre-nationhood throughout the Torah is we were there. We eyewitnessed it. Here in these 95 verses is an episode that happened where we were totally unaware that on a hilltop above us were two powerful non-Jews who were joining in order to wreak havoc and devastation on the Jewish people. And God alone, handled the situation for us on our behalf, repeatedly confounded Bilaam so that they did not succeed, and then chose to include it in the Torah to teach us what was going on while we were just carrying on our daily lives in an encampment without knowing the drama that took place. This is testimony of God recorded by Moshe Rabbeinu, and he too was unaware of what was going on. And it's here in the Torah with full confidence that it happened the way it's written. And even though we were not eyewitnesses, to be able to tell our children and our children's children throughout the generations what happened. Now, this requires us to review how different things are other times. For example, when Bnei Israel, the people of Israel, came out of Egypt, Paro changed his mind. Instead of letting them go, he formed an elite military force to pursue the Israelites. And when they were sandwiched between hills to the right and hills to the left, mountains, and the sea in front of them, and they looked back and they saw the pursuing Egyptians, they cried out to God. And God says to Moshe, tell the people, what are you crying for? Watch, Hashem yilachem lachem. God will fight for you, va'atem tacharishun, and you will stand by silently. So there is another example where God fought for us against our enemy, but that time we saw what was happening, and we acknowledged God with the song of the sea. And that's sort of like the problem of doing something for somebody without that person knowing that you did something. So sometimes the person has to know. And in this case, that God chose to include in the Torah the whole episode of Bilaam and Balak was to make sure that we know that there was this kind of threat in the world, and that this threat was perceived by God, so to speak, as so strong that he decided to take care of the whole thing by himself. Then you have, for example, the attack of Amalek. At the attack of Amalek, Moshe tells Yehoshua, form an army and go fight against Amalek. And God joins them and declares that the battle against Amalek is a perennial battle between God and Amalek and between Israel and Amalek, and God and Israel join forces in order to vanquish or hold at bay the Amalek and the Amalek types of the world. So that's yet a different kind. So God helps us, God fights for us, and God sometimes fights for us and we don't even know anything about it. That's a very, very high level of protection from God. The next point, I think, should be fairly obvious, and that is if we behave properly and we are faithful to God, then no nation, no matter how strong or otherwise, will be able to vanquish us, because God is always going to protect us. Hine lo yanum v'lo yishan shomer Yisrael. The protector of Israel does not slumber or sleep. He is always there to protect us. What follows from that is, when he doesn't protect us, It's because he chooses not to. Because there is no idea that he has too much on his plate in order to help. He is all-powerful, and we have to take that sobering note that if something bad happens to the nation, then it's because God allowed it to happen. Then you have the last nine psukim. And Bilam and Balak and whoever thought of the idea came up with a brilliant plan to harm Israel. And that is set the stage for our own shooting ourselves in the foot. I can't think of a better term than that for what happens at the end of Balak. Because God was fighting for us for 95 psukim, almost to the point where what happened with Bilam and Balak is like a comedy, a comical farce. And then that advice that they dreamed up of seducing, having their women seduce the men of Israel, worked for them like a charm. Because now God got angry at us, and it doesn't matter how strong we are and how weak our enemies are, we will be hurt badly. And the fact that the Sidra ends with only 24,000 dead is thanks to the jealous, zealous act of Pinchas Ben Elazar ben Aharon HaKohen, an act which our sages say, had he requested permission or asked a halachic ruling as to whether he's allowed to do what he ended up doing, they would have to say no. He didn't ask. He was a kanai. And he, as we will see in the beginning of next week, said, acted properly and succeeded. But it was a very, very controversial thing for him to do. But before that, the fact that we shot ourselves in the foot, we made ourselves vulnerable to God's anger, where our enemies, in this case Bilam and Balak, probably sat back laughing and let bygones be bygones about Bilam's failure to proactively curse the people, because look what happened to ourselves. Now, I hate to put it in this context, but I can't help it. We in Israel have enemies who try to hurt us and kill us. So it could be a terrorist with knives, or a terrorist with a gun, or a terrorist with a firebomb, or a terrorist with a suicide belt, or a terrorist with a car waiting to hurt somebody or kill somebody. But even when that is not occurring, we are saddened by episodes where we are clearly messing ourselves up. This morning's news mentioned that three people had died in two different fatal accidents yesterday. Yesterday, or the day before, we had another case of a baby being left in a car alone, where the person who was driving that car later said, simply forgot that the kid was in the back, and the kid died. No enemy had to come and stab it. No enemy had to come and shoot a missile against it. We did it to ourselves. And the same thing goes in any battle that we undertake. We must make sure that the ingredients are either helpful, or at least not harmful, and we should concentrate on the proper way to protect ourselves. I think I got that a little wrong, but I think you get my drift. So if one day we hear about a pigua, a terrorist attack, and the next day we hear about death by a different source, and we realize that we're doing it to ourselves, then that's part of the story of Bilam and Balak also. And we have to always remember that lesson. We have to remain faithful to God, and we have to keep the Torah and its mitzvot, and then we become or remain invincible. Now, I have to say that all of the above is kind of simplified and maybe a bit of exaggeration. I believe it, but I believe that it doesn't explain why bad things happen to good people as individuals. Without actually saying it in advance, what I was talking about mostly is the nation of Israel, not individual Jews. Hopefully, an individual Jew's fate will follow the positive steps that the people of Israel in general are doing, and not necessarily go along with the negative, but that we never know. And so it is an oversimplification to a certain extent, but it is very true that our fate is determined or determinable by how faithfully we remain to God. Finally, we come to another lesson in this week's Seder, and that is that Pinchas, one single person, Ben Elazar, Ben Aaron HaKohen, acts in such a way that it wipes out the plague that had smitten up to this point 24,000 people, and the plague ends, and God's anger ends, all brought about by one single person. And that is a very powerful lesson, that one person can change the tide when it's working against us. One single person. Now, the fact of the matter is that this Seder, and there's one other that I would put in the same category, ends in a very, very dramatic cliffhanger.